It's Wednesday, March 24th, 2010, and you're listening to episode 186 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 57 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name's Pat.
Welcome back, Dan.
It's good to be back. And of course, by the time this episode drops, Fear the Con will be over. And I'm sure we'll be pleased with how it turned out. But as of right now, I have no idea how it's going to go because this is the Tuesday before Fear the Con. I'm picking people up from the airport tomorrow, followed by all the festivities. So right now, I'm pretty frazzled. But hey, nice. By the time this drops, everything will be back to normal.
Hey, you know, as frazzled as we are, which is always true in the lead up to the cons, it's been going really smooth this year.
Well,
last year, I mean, we were running around like crazy this week.
I think we're on a learning curve that has diminishing returns. We learned an enormous amount after doing Fear the Con 1.
Mm-hmm.
We learned a big amount after doing Fear the Con 2. And it seems like this year we're learning less because we're getting less wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I've already...
Well, and watched five people show up this year.
Well, yeah, of course, we say this before the con occurs. Yeah. Watch it actually turn into like a firefight midway through or something.
Nice.
I already have some new ideas for Fear the Con 4, but I will say compared to Fear the Con 1 and 2, the prep work for Fear the Con 3 has gone very smoothly. The last minute panic I'm going through is really only because of one thing. Writer's block on a game.
Really?
That's it. Everything else, the badges,
maybe it's just not
scheduling.
A con game for you unless you're writing it 10 minutes before your game starts.
I don't, honestly, I don't know. And I'm really contemplating something I may do different for Fear the Con 4 is only stick to things that are more like mini-based games, like the Star Trek battle, BattleTech.
No, I don't think you should. I think people would be disappointed if you don't run a full
Your strong
game.
Point is a strong story. You can always do what I did. I was having a problem with the end of my game. Then I go to the bathroom. I think about it. And
yeah, that doesn't work for me.
It all comes out. The game that is.
Doesn't work for me.
Well,
and so the other thing is like I get stressed out. So I try a stress reliever. Like I'll have a little bit of wine or beer or something. Mm-hmm. And then I just get tired and take a nap.
Nice.
And then I wake up and even less time remains before the con. And I'm even more panicked. So
see, this is why you should go no note style, do totally off the
top. Then I'll be even more panicked.
Well, and you know what, for this kind of, again, we're dropping this after the con, but for us it's a couple days before. In our little back room area on our forums, we've talked about the possibility that A, no one could show up to this and then we'd be really disappointed and embarrassed, or a huge amount of people show up, too many people show up and they just don't have enough to do, and about how all the hosts would drop everything that they're doing and just run more games so that they have stuff to do. I'm not signed up to run any games this year because I want to kind of run the con, but I actually have in mind two different games that I'm going to run if needs be. So
I will say, though, absolutely, this year has been much easier to set up than previous years. We knew what needed to be done. We weren't figuring things out at last minute, so we were able to space out the prep time. Con Planner has been much easier to work with.
That is awesome. I love
Warhorn.
The Con Planner that you've made.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to expanding that over the coming months for other cons, and then, of course, also improving it for Fear the Con 4. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I'm sure by the time this drops, we'll have a much better idea of what really happened.
Yeah.
So rather than playing amateur psychic, real quick, Reyna's Wings, just want to mention this real briefly. They are still taking donations for that, and the donations will go on for a while. So if you are wiped out right at the moment financially, they are taking the donations for some time to come. I will put a link in the show notes. There's a little bit of time before the walk actually occurs, but then they leave it open after the walk so people can continue to donate. So if you want to get your money counted towards basically the pissing rights of who collected the most, then get your stuff in soon. If you're just looking to donate to the cause, then I'll leave that link up and we'll mention it here and there over the coming show. So once again, great cause. Get involved if you can.
That's one competition I can get behind.
Yeah.
Who collects the most amount of money for charity? Because you know what? Everybody wins in that contest.
All right. So I saw something, actually, I think it was earlier today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to give props here where I saw it. This was posted, if memory serves, by Michael, who's a user on our forums as well. Was posted over on the Kicked in the Dice Bags forums, and he linked to a guy who has done this massive home renovation to make the inside of his house look like a D&D dungeon. I guess. I'm not 100% sure what he's going for. I'll link this off the show notes if I can dig up the link.
If it's one I think it is, I've seen it on our forums too. The ultimate gaming room where they've got, basically the house looks like a dungeon, but they've also got sound built in. There's smoke machines, there's lighting effects.
Yeah, there's like a locked cage, which is a closet, but it's got like a prison door where he keeps all the board games.
You know, I've been actually in a few rooms like this. Now, it wasn't for the kind of role playing you're thinking about, but yeah, pretty cool stuff.
You dirty, dirty boy.
Hey, you're the one who brought up dungeons and, you know, making a dungeon in your
basement.
But you're
the one who brought up spanking and gimp masks.
Well, I mean, you know,
actually,
hey.
I don't think he said either of those words.
I didn't. See how that just naturally came to mind for you?
Look, he doesn't need to say those words.
There is a ton of role-playing in Dungeons and Drag Queens. I don't care.
It's not all about
the
combat.
It's not just a war game, all right?
Yeah.
It's not just a dungeon crawl. Very important.
You're going down a deep, dark hole, yes, but...
And there is crawling.
So here's my question to you guys and to the listeners. You guys have to chime in on the forums or on the blog, unless you happen to know my phone number, which I don't think any of you
do. He won't answer anyway.
Yeah, I won't answer anyway. But the question is, let's say you had a relatively unlimited budget. Now, you are stuck with today's technology, okay? Right. So you cannot do anything.
Holodecks.
Yeah, no holodecks. It has to be something that could be done today with our technology and level special effects. That's rule one, okay?
So no zero-G Kama Sutra.
Exactly. Our level of technology is rule one. Rule two is we were only talking about the inside of the house. What would you rebuild your house to look like? And I guess we'll throw in a rule three here of, well, let's just say there's no social impact of this. You don't have to worry about your wife pitching a fit because when she brings her parents over, it's a D&D house or something like that. For me, I would go to the opposite end. I'd go science fiction. There's a guy who's gotten a fair amount of press over the years who rebuilt the inside of his house to look like...
It wasn't a house. It was a one-room apartment.
Yeah, but he rebuilt the whole thing to look like a room... out of something out of Star Trek. I don't remember what specifically he was going for. Something out of Star Trek.
It looks amazing, but I've read interviews and articles about this guy, and it is total form over function. He sleeps on the floor. He has almost no personal possessions because you can't put them anywhere. And everything is absolutely, like the kitchen and dining area and stuff, absolutely as minimal as it can go.
Yeah,
so it doesn't
spoil the
look.
He's trying to sell it, but no one will buy the thing, or not, at least not for the price that he wants.
He has a company, well, a company that I don't think gets any business, but that will take a room in your house and he'll make it like that. He'll renovate your room to make it look like his apartment and stuff.
But I think
it looks amazing.
I think that's where I would go is science fiction. Mm-hmm. I would make up the inside of my house to look something like a starship.
Yeah.
Now, unlike him, I think I would include function with the form. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the dining area, while it may be all black and silver and reflective surfaces and things like that, you'd still have chairs and a place to eat. Mm-hmm. You know, for a computer... it might be set up to look like a console on a bridge, but nonetheless, it still works. The main view screen is actually a plasma TV that really does get cable and play Xbox.
You know, I saw something really cool like that where the guy had this massive home theater system, right? And instead of just some nice, really comfy couches in the big home theater system, he designed it to look like it was on the Nautilus. It was so cool looking.
So that's my question here, though, to you guys. Assuming those couple of rules, what would you guys build your houses to look like?
This one's easy for me. Well, the house itself, when you come up to the house, would look nice, normal house.
Yeah, with no exterior. We're only talking interior.
When you come inside, it's going to be a nice, normal-looking house upstairs. You know, nice dinner table. You know, nice living room where you could just entertain people normally. And then you go over to the grandfather clock, open it up, and there's a bat pole leading to the basement where all the cool stuff is. And then the basement would be as close to like the 1950s bat cave as I could get.
Giant Penny and everything?
Yeah, the Penny wasn't in the 50s TV show, though.
Yeah.
But pretty much any bat cave. That's the whole point, is upstairs is normal. You bring people over, you host it, you do completely normal. The cool stuff is for me. Just me. I go down the bat pole. I go
even be
in
your
there.
Gaming room or anything.
Nobody can see me dressed as Batman in the Batcave. Not gonna happen.
Except certain highly trained paid professionals.
That
specialist.
The one hole here in your design, which Chad pointed out when we were kicking this around pre-recording, is the first time you go down that bat pole. Maybe after a little bit too much of a Thanksgiving dinner, maybe just didn't quite have a good grip on it, and you hit down in an unintended way, and now the emergency rescue workers have to come and get you.
The whole area would be cushioned, and there would have to be stairs going up. Like, Alfred doesn't take the bat pole down. Alfred goes downstairs.
I want to tell you right now that Alfred goes down on the pole.
And come on, are you trying to say that Wayne doesn't know how to get a good grip on his pole?
I think he does. So there's Wayne.
It's all about experience.
There's
right.
Wayne lying in a crumpled heap at the bottom of his pole, cape, cowl, no pants on, broken ankle.
Totally worth it.
With a pile of half-dead paramedics on top of him.
Totally worth it.
They call, I've got an emergency. I fell and broke my ankle. Okay, sir, where are you? I can't tell you.
No, I think what more likely would happen is I'd get down there safely. I'd be playing around in the Batmobile and the exhaust from it because there's no exit for the car would get to me.
Yeah. So you start having like visions of gypsies and then just go to a comfortable sleep and never wake up again.
Wow. Totally worth it.
Yeah. He'd go out happy. It'd be great.
Pat? Somehow for you, I'm picturing Elvis's house with the themed rooms, the jungle room.
I'm picturing something with a sex swing. I know that.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Once again, Elvis's house.
Chris downstairs.
I'd want more of something like the Kennedy, you know, secret room in the White House. But, yeah, that's beyond the point. No, actually, I'm going to go the opposite of you, Dan, for a couple reasons. But instead of going sci-fi, I like old world style, like particularly sort of like the old pub look.
Okay.
Sort of like maybe it's not really maybe Tudor style or whatever like that, but like the old English pub kind of a thing. And for me, it would be just like in the basement, not the whole house. Although I think Tudor style is really cool, but that sort of is the outside as well. But I like that just because, again, I sort of like the fantasy role playing thing. So if you can sort of reproduce sort of that pub feel or the the kind of buildings that you would be in that time frame, I think that would look really neat. And the other side of that is in talking like what you were mentioning at the front of the episode is if you ever needed to sell it, I think that it's easier to sell that kind of a thing because since that's happened in actuality, it's not going to be something that looks cheesy. As opposed to if you're going for sci-fi looking,
well,
if you're
going for a scene,
I know, but
resale value does not figure.
No, but here's what I mean: if you're talking about sci-fi, if you're trying to make something look sci-fi today, 10 years from now. What you think is sci-fi could look really cheesy, but
well,
on the flip side,
when you go
if
past
I'm making,
that, it's going to look retro and great.
Well, there you go too. But yeah, if I'm making something look like it looked 200 years ago, that doesn't change.
You know what
it's
else
always
cool
going
to
be
that,
that.
Pat, I'm envisioning murder mystery dinners at your house.
Well, sure.
How
yeah.
How cool would that be to go to a murder mystery dinner?
No,
at Pat's
I'm envisioning
house.
Sexy murder mystery dinners going on in his house.
But, yeah, the Victorian age.
Who murdered Bob? Who stole my pants?
Hey. Some of the best risque Victorian porn. It's good stuff. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So the question, though, was what do you want out of your house? Not what does the potential next owner want out of your house?
Well, no, but what I was saying is, like I said, there are many reasons. I like that time period, but it's also, it's something that you can sort of accomplish. It's not just so.
The house
it's
an escrow the rest of the money.
Oh, well, you say what you will. It's also functional. I like it. It's a cool time period to me.
It's also something that's, you know, with a deck.
Now, for the record, in my case, both the top and the bottom of the house are redone. The top is done to look really fancy, but the bottom is cooler because it's contrast,
you know,
the top and
we can go really wild. I'll put an island in the kitchen.
Chad mentioning pool in the house, though, would come to my second one.
You know, I'm just going to find your couch, and you know what I'm going to do to it.
Yeah.
My second choice, if I couldn't do my sci-fi one, would be the house from the beginning of the movie 2010. where the guy had, like, the inside of the house was almost like Hacienda style, mm-hmm. where the rooms lined a central courtyard mm-hmm. that was inside. And in that courtyard was a large pool that he had dolphins in.
You and your friggin' dolphins. Ever since high school, he's like, I'm going to have dolphins when I grow up. It's like, no, you're not. Yes, I am. It's going to be a big pool. And we'll be friends.
Right. I'm dying to know what Chad's house would be.
All right, Chad, what is yours going
to
be?
So mine would be, when you pull up to it, it's a house. Like, in a the land would have to be a little bit bigger, so it wouldn't be like this compact subdivision neighborhood, but it would be a normal-looking, very small house. It would be very tiny, one story. It'd have, like, a little garage and stuff. When you entered it, the entire house is completely bare. It's like somebody moved out, right? And somebody's selling the house. But there's a door, like a hidden door, like Wayne's, you know, you pull something and a panel would open up. And I wouldn't have a bat pole, but I'd have a staircase going down. And at the bottom of the staircase, and this, the entire living area of the house would be completely subterranean. It'd be completely underground. And the door is a fallout shelter door, one of those big, like, navy, you know, thick bulkhead doors.
Right.
You go in it, and the whole thing is a bomb shelter, but like a big bomb shelter, the size of a house, same square footage as a house. You'd have like conduits going along the wall, and you'd have all, you know, exposed piping.
It's
and,
like
and
a then, Cheyenne Mountain kind of thing.
Yeah,
I was wondering if you're starting like Vault 101.
So, I was about to say, it says Vault Tech.
Get the Vault thing out. I mean,
no, I'm picturing
Fallout
like,
is cool and all, but Fallout is its own style, and I wouldn't be following a Fallout style, but a bomb shelter style.
Yeah,
right?
I'm picturing more like so, Cheyenne Mountain or here, the...
Yeah, only without, I couldn't, you know, pull a main battle tank in there or anything like that. Right. It's still the size of a house, square footage wise. But here's the thing about it that I think would make it cool. There are, anachronisms is the wrong word, but there's out of place things in the house. So what these are the scavenged items, not from the wasteland, but these are, the bombs are coming and we have 20 minutes, so we're going to bring stuff in to the bomb shelter to make it more homey. So you go into like my office would be concrete walls and the exposed lighting and the exposed wires and the pipes and stuff. But then a carpet would be laid down like a Persian rug. And on top of that is a very ornate desk with a nice chair and such. And it's totally out of place. It's something that they grabbed and moved down there.
If you've ever seen any of the specials where they go into the now declassified bomb shelters they built for like Congress or the president, mm-hmm. that is exactly what they look
that's
like.
That's why I want
where it's like
the
concrete corridor, exposed mm-hmm. wiring, conduits, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then you turn a corner and here's something that looks just like the press room in the White House.
Right.
I mean, exactly like it.
And then you go into the kitchen and the kitchen area is like sort of pseudo cafeteria style, but there's a jukebox in there. And it's just different, like, scavenged stuff. Along the walls are concrete walls, but they have really nice framed pictures and pieces of art hanging on the wall. And it's this contrast of, you know, really industrial, cold, utilitarian space that is filled with these comfortable, homey objects that make both of them look out of place. And really, if you go to like a downtown urban area and you see like warehouse lofts and stuff, unless they're totally renovated, you see a lot of that style in lofts in those sort of rehabs and stuff. And I really, really like that contrast. Actually, it's something that Wayne and I were talking about. If we weren't married and, you know, if I didn't have a kid, and what would we be doing now? I would totally live in downtown St. Louis in a renovated loft. I love that style. I love how that looks.
I find it interesting that two of us chose our, you know, our big renovations to be underground, away from people.
Well, yeah, I guess mine would technically be away from people, but I would actually have people come to my house.
Oh, people would come to my house all the time, and I'd get a kick that they don't know what's downstairs. That's part of the fun.
Like I said at the beginning of the episode, I've been in some rooms where that was exactly the case. Most people that visit the house have no idea what's down here.
Wow.
Okay.
you've got to quit visiting Chris, Pat.
I know. Well, it's
now for the entire rest of the episode, Pat's not going to say a word. He's going to be looking off, staring off into space, and his hand is going to be uncomfortably below the table.
Yeah. That's about it. Yeah.
All right. So moving on to, I don't know, something.
More PG-rated topics?
No, it probably won't be. what we want to talk about in this episode is relationships. Okay, we're talking about the role-playing relationships. We're not talking about actual person-to-person relationships. This is not a Fear the Interpersonal Conflict episode. But one of the things that we have talked about a couple times on this show, or at least kind of brushed past, is the fact that there's this weird cognitive dissonance in the way that we role play, which is this. As people, while there are some varying tastes and tolerance regarding the level of combat, the degree of role playing that's needed, etc., etc. I mean, someone like me, I am happy doing a dungeon crawl or whatnot.
You disgust me.
I know. And that's the different opinion. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
We do all agree that we do enjoy the deeper role-playing games, okay? That may not be our only option, but at least we all do enjoy that. And we put a lot of thought into making these characters as consistent, as deep, as interesting, as innovative, as fluid and growing as we possibly can, except for one thing. They have almost no relationships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They, you know,
except to each other, I
except
guess.
To each other.
You know, and it's something that bothers me. I mean, if you look, every one of us sitting here at this table recording right now is married. So I think it's safe to say that we all see that to be something that we have strived for, something we wanted out of our lives. But I have never seen any of us at the table have that be something our character is striving for.
Well, and growing up, or even into adulthood prior to marriage, how much time and energy did you spend thinking about wanting to find someone, whether it was for romantic purposes or purely sexual purposes?
I only wish to breed.
But you know the point. But that takes up a huge amount of thought.
Fat's face. I wish this was a video cast. Oh,
if that's all you're in it for, Chad, you're spending way too much time with Pat.
Yeah.
That's not going to work.
What? Mm. But he promised.
But that aspect is completely missing from our characters. And I don't think it's just romance. If you look at our characters in general, as you said, Chad, they may have relationships to each other. But beyond that, what do they have? Well, maybe contacts.
Yeah.
But come on, that's not a relationship. Some guy you can call in a crunch to bail you out of jail is not a real relationship.
Or I've seen PCs have relationships written into their history, but they're not real relationships. I've seen people write characters up that are great. They have kids. They have a wife. They have a network of friends. They have families. They have mothers and fathers that weren't killed to drive them to revenge against blah, 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 blah. But it's just that. It's history. And it never really comes up. There might be like a role play dialogue back and forth where it's, my mother and father were killed by the harpies and I must get revenge. Oh, really? Mine are running the inn down the road. They're great. I love them. They've never been touched by harpies.
And you know, once they leave town, they never even think about it.
Yeah,
again.
It never comes up. And the reason I think you see that a lot, and of course there's exceptions to every rule. I think that there's tons of groups out there that develop real fake relationships between their fake characters with NPCs and such. I think the reason you don't see it a whole lot is because games are travel, generally. You play adventures. You're in a sci-fi game. You get in a ship. You fly off. You're playing a fantasy game. You're traveling 1,000 miles to chuck a MacGuffin into a volcano. And you're in a modern-day game, and while you maybe are not going globetrotting around the world, or you could be, you're always out doing something and you just don't have the time, so you're always traveling. Very few games take place in a city or in a town, in a community, and involve just the community and don't really go outside the community. I think that there's a couple out there like Eberron, where it takes place in a city. So people say, oh, Eberron takes place in a city. That's what you're talking about. No, Eberron is a world. It just happens to be the size of a city. You know, it's so complex. It's so big. Very it's so hopeless, detailed.
Yeah.
And going across town is like me going to France. It's so massive and so
detailed. What about something like Vampire the Masquerade, though? It seems like it's not vast traveling. That's more close.
I think, though, there's another thing that figures into that. Even if you take out travel, the game is still very forward-looking. You're not looking at the present or the past. There is something we need to
do. Are you saying spouses and children are boat anchors that hold you down.
In a role-playing game, I think that's exactly how they're treated.
They are. I think that's how they're treated.
I'm not saying that should be the case. And I've got a couple things here on why I think people struggle with this, or at least we struggle.
Because I've got some ideas, too.
Well, do you remember when...
The differences mine are good.
Dan, do you remember when we were...
And they wonder why I don't say anything.
But my point being, though, that just to finish that thought real quick, is that these games are forward-looking. Mm-hmm. There's a dragon you have to kill, a maiden you have to save, a world-ending plot. You have to stop them from summoning Dagon. Mom and Dad don't figure into this picture, generally speaking. Those are just kind of the accoutrements.
Well, if it's epic level, you can dial it back. Like the Skies of Glass game that we just played. Not that Skies of Glass is inherent to this, but I'm just using that as an example. We played people who were from a small town, and all of our characters had family in the town, and all of our characters were motivated by our family members in different ways. Some of them positive, like Pat's character's family. Some of them negative, like my character's family. And the plot was epic conceptually, but it was something that was taking place in a region and that was affecting our characters on a regional level. So we traveled within the region, but we knew where home was.
Yeah.
And we always came back home, and we didn't necessarily want to say home was not the starting point for the adventure that we would never see again because the ending point of the adventure was 1,000 miles away. So we had that. But I also remember a game that we played. And I can't give you a year, but it was post the teenage years with all of our stupid characters and dumb ideas that all the mistakes everyone makes. But before we got into really deep role playing, we were playing a lot of D&D, and our D&D games were always the Tolkien-esque stuff. It was always, here's your starting point. You get the quest and you travel 1,000 miles, chuck a ring in a volcano, you know, conceptually. And I demanded that we play a different kind of D&D game, a game where we did the game in a keep. We didn't have this huge city-wide castle, but we had a keep, and the keep had a village, and the entire thing took place in the keep and in the small surrounding areas. And that doesn't mean within that small surrounding areas is a huge, gigantic dungeon that we go to, and then that's how we get away from that homeness. But the whole point of the campaign was that it involved the home, and it involved these relationships.
And this actually ties in perfectly to my second point, and then we'll give Pat an opportunity to talk, which is, I think one of the reasons it doesn't come up a lot is because even when you take out that element of the plot being forward-looking, the plot is also group-oriented, that this is what we are trying to do together. Now, your relationship with your mom and dad or your siblings or your wife or whatever in many role-playing games simply doesn't figure into it because that has nothing to do with anyone else at the table or anyone else's character. What was different about that Skies of Glass game, and what I think we can leverage from that into useful advice, is make those relationships not just relevant to the plot, because I think that's a mistake, that, and I'm going to come back to that here in a little bit, but to make them instead relevant to the group. I'll keep picking on the Skies of Glass game. There was a family that owned a farm. This farm was a significant chunk of land out of a particular town. I mean, they weren't big power brokers, but they still, this was a noteworthy family. Pat was their son. Dave was an adopted son. Chad's character, you are not exactly adopted, but you kind of hung out there all the time.
Yeah.
And so the three of you kind of grew up as brothers, even though none of you were actually related. The three of you grew up as brothers. And so what happened to that family mattered to all of you. It was not just a consideration of Pat's parents might suffer, but if Pat's parents were suffering, that was going to impact Dave's character and Chad's character. And so these relationships became important to everybody. And there's other ways you could do this. We could play a game, let's say, take like a World of Darkness game, where Chad is an investigative reporter, and there's a woman that's his, I don't know, his camera woman. And maybe that woman is my character's wife or something like that. And so now all of a sudden these relationships start to become important to everyone. Pat, what's going
You're sort of hitting on something that I was talking about. And I'm actually going to take a totally different tack than what you guys are talking about. I think your points are very valid. But for me, I think it's a little bit different in the fact of I look at it as in any type of relationship, and not just necessarily mom and dad or your wife, but I mean, if I'm just playing a character that's unattached, you know, a male character that's doing whatever, I might be interested in the one of the female NPCs that show up that's particularly attractive or whatever. And so, you know, try to develop that. And I think what you hit on right there is that what that means is at that point, I'm going to be flirting and or pursuing a relationship that is being played by your GM. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that is a big stumbling block. I think that's something that maybe a lot of people either they don't really care to do. It seems
you can't flirt with Anne when Anne is being played by Ted.
Exactly. But now that being said,
not only could it be creepy, but if you created that character and gave it over, you're essentially giving your
And I'm not even saying giving it over. I'm not even saying that because I've actually played in a couple campaigns like this. One in particular where it was we'll call it Playboy World, just because everybody in it was beautiful. just all the people in it were beautiful. There were no ugly people. Period. That's just kind of the world he ran. Yeah. If you were ugly, it's like, why would you be ugly? We're all Playboy playmates.
Throw you off a cliff.
Exactly.
Ugly babies get thrown off the cliff.
You know, on the other side of it.
Piled up at the bottom of Wayne's bat pole.
Well, yeah.
Sparta, if Sparta was all models.
But in this setting, that would happen. You would have these NPCs that would interact with the party, whatever, that they would sort of be around and relationships happen. But what it was it was flirtation with the male GM, whatever, not male,
hot.
Male. Yeah, so at the table. And you've got to have, say, maybe a GM that's comfortable doing that. And maybe most people aren't. Like, if I'm running the game, I'm not going to come in and worry about having to flirt with Wayne this week or develop this side or the other. I think that's kind of part of it, too, because you can do this thing where it's centered around. And like I said, mm-hmm. in this setting, it was all these NPCs. It was the shopkeeper that ran, that ran the magic shop or whatever, or this out of there. These are people that we saw all the time, or even some people that we encounter, some of the bad people, mm-hmm. an NPC along those lines, but they sort of became part of that campaign. So they were around and relationships were developed and it did play into the story. I just think that maybe,
talking specifically about romantic relationships mm-hmm. within a game, there are a couple things I came up with that seem to make those difficult within a game, or I think, at least within our group, have played into why they almost never come up. In fact, in the entire time I have role-played, which is, over 20 years now, I have only had a character fall in love with an NPC once.
Mm.
One game. That is the only character I've ever had out of the dozens, if not hundreds, I've played. One character has had a romantic interest, which obviously does not jive with the way the real world works.
Right.
But
does that count Dave and Pat's sister?
That was a point of humor in the game more than anything else. But here's the things that I came up with. One is the one that Chad raised, which is, yes, it's role-playing. Yes, it's imaginary. But there is some part of you that is still grounded in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, it's really hard for me to get into the emotion of the moment to think about how I'm swooning for this girl that's actually being played by big burly Chad.
Exactly.
And
that's my point.
Now,
it's hot.
You know what? Maybe that's a limitation of imagination on my part. Maybe that's a limitation of my abilities as a role player. I don't know.
It's hard to flirt with Anne when Anne is being played by Ted.
Exactly. It's just truth. I'm not mm-hmm. saying it's right, wrong. I'm just saying that's the way it is for me.
Well, for me, I've never had a PC that has had any kind of romantic relationship at all, ever, in all the time I've played. I haven't even gotten to that point to where, I have a hard time looking at Dan and trying to flirt with him. It's a matter of...
No, you did have one.
Did I?
Yes. One of your characters fell in love with Dawn's character because you were flirting with her.
Oh, yeah. That's before we were going together, too.
Yes.
That's not an NPC, though. That's another player.
I think that's borderline cheeky ground thinking, there. I see the element of that.
I didn't limit it to NPCs. Romance in general.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, is that I'm just not interested in that. It's not why I come to the table. And it isn't an uncomfortable thing. I just don't care. It's not why I'm in it.
I think I would cut the difference. It's not the thing that draws me to the table. But for me, building an immersive experience is part of the package. Yeah,
I don't want to focus on it, but for me, I have a problem with my character if I don't see that as a potential in his future. If throughout the campaign, he hasn't had interactions with females whatsoever, I want basically when the campaign's over, if he's alive at the end of it, I want to be able to see him going on, having a family, having kids.
Yeah.
And I want to have worked towards that I don't want to focus on. I just want it to be an option.
And this could play into the next potential problem, which is, all right, I think all of us at one point or another in our life either have known the person or been the person where you're buddies with somebody, and until they meet Mr. or Mrs. Right, and all of a sudden they disappear. Now, the same thing can happen in a role-playing game in that, look, a romance, if it's going to be done with any amount of believability, or forget even romance, any relationship at all, a friendship, a brother-sister relationship.
A bromance.
Sure. You know, these types of things take time to develop. And while you are developing them, the spotlight is either on one player in the GM or maybe two players, depending on exactly what the relationship is. But you are focusing a spotlight on a narrow number of people. And I think there is a balancing act here where you can do this sufficiently to develop the relationship without boring the other players to tears, just like you have to handle any other number of side issues. But I think it is hard to do this right without excluding everyone else from the game that's in progress.
I see what you're saying there, but I don't know about that. I think it's just like you said, it's just like any other side project. If it's going to be done, it's just like if you're going to focus the spotlight on, say, Chad's character versus any other type of a character development. I really don't think that it's that much different. Again, I'm going back to it. I just think that it has to be the comfort level. You have to be comfortable with doing this kind of a topic. And I think that's what is the issue with a lot of it. You don't see a lot of it in games. Like you say, you've only had it happen one time than all the games you've ever played. And honestly, I've only really been in one campaign myself where that was really sort of the norm and where it did happen. So, and again, it just happened that GM was comfortable doing that kind of thing, was fine with focusing on that aspect of role-playing life. So you had it happen and it wasn't abnormal. It didn't feel out of place in that campaign. But it was, you know, everybody was comfortable with it. It was like, okay, it's not weird. We're beyond that and it's fine.
Let me break comfort into two issues, because I think there are two types of comfort figure into this. One is self-consciousness. It's cheesy to do.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, whether it's a romantic relationship, whether it's a mother, a son relationship, whether it's, you know, whatever it may be, it makes you very self-conscious to try and role play out those awkward relationships that are part of real life.
Tough Carl doesn't want to sit at the table and say, I love you, man.
To another guy.
The second comfort issue, and this one I think would be limited to romantic relationships, is, let's be honest here for a minute. Let's say we were in a really intense role-playing game. The RP is really heavy, and any one of our wives was present, and a romance develops between a player character and that person's wife, and it ain't the husband. How much do you trust the people at your table? Even if you trust them,
well, I think
how much are you just opening the door for a problem?
It depends on the level of role-playing. I mean, if it's no one's acting anything out, nobody is speaking in voice, nobody is playing really, really deep, heavy acting RP, and people are doing stuff like, my character takes her character out to dinner. Okay. Roll a d20, 19, you guys had a great night. Okay, back to it.
You know, I also see a huge difference between two characters in a relationship, two players versus a player and an NPC. There's a huge difference there to me.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. And the player and NPC is just the much safer route to go.
Yes,
I absolutely agree.
I would say, because in my experience, I've never actually witnessed or had that happen where it was two PCs. It was, for me, it was always me and an NPC. So, yeah. And I agree. I think it could get weird there.
I've never encountered it,
so I don't know.
Especially if we're talking romance. Yes. I think other kinds of relationships you could develop between two PCs. But yes, I think for romance, I completely agree that you're probably going to have a much simpler time, because not only are you eliminating the issues of personal trust, personal comfort, but also with the GM, they're already playing the entire world as it is. You're already picturing them as 1,000 different people. Why not throw in a girlfriend as one of the 1,000 different people?
I do have to take that back. Now I think about it more. There was one guy in that campaign that it was a guy who was playing a female character. She was an elf. She was really hot. And I'm pretty sure I had a thing for her, and I think I tried to hit that. So maybe that is kind of along that same line. So I think I've muddied the waters myself. So yeah, it wasn't just the GM. It was even a fellow player character. So okay, there we go.
You know, besides
I'm going to the well again.
Besides the concern of that, our Skies of Glass game illustrated another concern. I mean, in that case, everyone did care about their family so much. we were afraid to follow the larger plot because we were afraid of what was going to happen to the town. That was an ongoing subject we kept talking about because everyone did care about. There was a lot of NPCs in that one that people cared about, not relationship, not like girlfriends or anything like that, but there were a lot of family members to the point that that slowed the campaign. That actually, it built a good stress, a good amount of tension, but it also slowed
see,
the actions.
That's why you guys need to play characters that have a lot of hatred and self-loathing built into them, and then they can just walk away.
Yeah, this elf in particular, she ended up dying, but it was okay because I had a string of others, so I wasn't really that concerned.
You guys were full of love and hope and relationships. My character was
broken. I'm going to agree and disagree. I'll start with the disagreement. The disagreement is, while I think those concerns did fill a large portion of the plot, I don't think it slowed it down. Because to me,
isn't that part of the play?
Bingo. Yeah. I mean, to me,
isn't that the caring?
The game is about a story put in motion by the GM and played out by the characters. And if the characters are concerned about their family and that figures into what they do, or maybe even stops them from chasing some portion of the plot, I, as a GM, should come into the game with an understanding that's going to happen, especially in this case where it was obvious it was going to happen.
Well, as long as the...
And that's part of the game.
As long as the discussion, the chewing on it, the sort of interacting with that aspect of the game is in character, I think it's fun. When it becomes out of character, it becomes boring. And what I mean by that is, should we follow point A that's going to harm the families and be a contention for our characters, or should we follow point B that's the safe road? If we're discussing this in character, if we're having to make in-character choices, if it's all this in character, that's great, that's awesome. But if we pull it out of in character and go meta, and we're doing the cost-benefit analysis of going A or B, and we're discussing which would it be more in character to do, and we spend a long time doing that, I hate that. I absolutely hate it. That is doing it wrong. I'm not saying that meta conversations are bad, but I'm just saying that when they take up so much time, when you can be having the same conversation in character, developing your character or doing in character things, that's what you should be going for. And that was my problem with the Skies of Glass campaign that we had, that nobody listening to this played in and wouldn't understand what we're talking about necessarily, but that some of these conversations were in character and they were people pointing the finger and saying, you're just a heartless son of a bitch and you don't care. It's like, well, you care too much and you're not willing to do what needs to be done. And those are great. Those are great interactions. But then there were also times when, you know, guys, I think it'd be good for the group if we actually put this plot on hold, put on the back burner, let it simmer for a while, and then we took this other job because, you know, it's going to pay well and the team needs this. And what do you think? What would be in care? What would your character say to that, Wayne? Well, I think my character would be kind of good with it because he's nervous about his father. It's like, you know, stop.
The other thing was, we got so into that game. I mean, an episode was done about, you know, about basically killing in games, because of how into the game people got. In character, arguing about things and how much people cared about the NPCs was what led to Pat occasionally sitting there with his head in his hands, stressed out. And I mean, it reached the point where
that was good times.
It was good times, but I don't know what that line is between when it's good times and when
I think
the game has just gotten stressful because you care too
much. I think the game goes too far when you're willing to set off nukes to create a nuclear wasteland and then deciding that you're really going to kill people to steal their food. Now, that's taking it a step
too
far.
Going back to the point where I agree with you, and this was something that I kind of touched on several minutes back in the episode, there is something that I have seen GMs do, and I have had discussions with players who have asked me specifically not to do this, is use relationships as a cheap plot hook. And I think this may be one of the reasons why a lot of players won't develop relationships. Because if I have a wife and two kids, that's a cheap vulnerability for the GM to exploit. When nothing else is working, my wife and kids get kidnapped, or my wife and kids get killed, or whatever. And so any relationship I have is the lazy game master's way of motivating or whatever. And so I have to spend 50% of my mental cycles in the game furthering the plot, and the other 50% making sure there's a hired guard, impenetrable fortress, and protective spells around girlfriend.
You know, it's a really sad thing, too, because I know when I create an NPC character or thing or something, I want the GM to pick up on that. I am creating it, so it's something that they can use to hook me. But again, I am the same way. I don't want to see this person kidnapped.
I find it amusing that you say that, Dan, because on one hand, you're saying that's like it's a bad thing, that people don't want to do it because the GM can use their family members against them, like you use somebody's sister against them.
Nothing happened to her.
Yeah, except he killed her. You talked about this in the last episode.
Yeah, well, first of all, that was years ago.
Yeah, I know.
That's because his character was completely out of control.
Oh, I know. You know what? Actually, I agree with you on both points. I'm just giving you crap.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So
I thought I'm sorry. Actually, you threw me for a minute because I thought you were talking about the Skies of Glass
system.
That's why I was like, what? Okay. Yes. I follow the joke now. But point being, that
I listened to the episode. Did you?
But it's I think something that game masters have to do, and I've played with players who have approached me and said, look, I want to have a wife and two kids,
I don't want to have a wife, two kids, and three bodyguards,
or a wife and two kids who are constantly kidnapped, dead, whatever. And so he said, I just want a metagame agreement between player and GM. You're not going to use them as a plot whip. And I said, fine, I agree to that. And never once did it come up. Yeah. Now, I mean, certainly there are the inevitabilities of if humanity is about to be wiped out by a marauding alien threat, well, that includes your family.
Except everyone on Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Which is where your family is.
But there was never anything like, okay, just to get to you, Colonel Bad Guy has kidnapped your
God,
wife.
God, I hate Colonel Bad Guy. Such a
He's a futuristic brother. He's the descendant of Baron Von Badass.
Well, I so would have used that name in an MMO now.
Yeah. But it's a slippery slope, I think, because you're playing characters in a setting where you've got bad guys that you're going up against. And what are bad guys going to do but try to use any exploitation they can against you? And you've got a family, but you don't want to have your family touched. So, you know what I mean? It's like, I understand that. Like, I totally understand the player.
Isn't that
the
what makes
character,
Spider-Man cool,
not,
though?
I want that family. I don't want them to be hostages all the time. But in a way, it's almost like, well, you can't have the best of both worlds there. If you go to all this trouble to have that, and you're out there fighting baddie of the week or whatever, or major baddie that is all you're always fighting against, you've got to be aware of that is something that can
that
happen.
That is something
now,
that if you're playing
that doesn't
super
mean that the GM should abuse it.
Now,
certainly, but I mean, just to pull it off the table completely is
shut
I don't
up,
think it's
Pat.
No, I'm on a roll. It's not fair. It's not fair for the GM to do that just to pick on the players, but it's also not fair for the PC to say, I'm taking this off the shelf. Right. I can't do this.
And especially, I actually completely agree with you, because I think that there are some games where that's part of the game. A superhero game. That's a massive trope.
That's why they have a secret identity.
Doesn't that like define Peter Parker? The whole character is defined not by who he is and who he punches, but his loved ones and the ones he protects.
Yep. And if you're Batman, you're going to have Robin the Boy hostage.
Yeah.
It's part of the trope. You're
why is he
it.
In yellow, orange, and green?
Because
he's Target
doesn't
Boy.
Like
Target
to get
Boy.
Hit.
That's
yeah,
right.
Exactly. Now, I actually take it from an opposite point. I don't like to write family members into my characters, or if I say, I mean, obviously I don't play test tube babies and clone babies for all my characters, but there's a family in there somewhere, but it's not important. It doesn't matter to me because quite frankly, I don't care. I want to concentrate on my character, and I don't want to say my character would do this, my character would this, he wouldn't do this, my dad would do this, my dad would do this, but he wouldn't do this, and if my character did this, what would my dad say? Like you were saying, those brain cycles.
Right.
I don't want to devote cycles to the family.
But isn't that something you could
set up? That's a preference. I don't think it's a bad thing. Well, I think it's great to write that in to other people's characters preferential-wise. I never do it. I don't like it.
I completely follow that, but
unless I'm sorry to interrupt you, but unless
I'm not sorry at all.
I have written in there if I create an NPC that is an uncle. I've done the uncle thing a couple times, or a father, whatever. If I create this NPC that's part of my character and totally 100% handed over to the GM. It's like, I have this character in my background, but I want you to play him.
That was going to be my point, is I see exactly what you're saying, but I, as a GM, would not allow that anyway, because really, if you're allowed to play, you and your wife and your two kids and your mom and dad and your three brothers.
What do you need the rest of the party for?
Yeah, you basically, I'm giving you effectively retainers or something.
I don't think
the way that I would do it and the way I have done it in the past is if someone gives me enough to work with, I say, look, just give me a couple sentences on these people. I mean, I'm not asking you to write me a novel, but just put down mom, three sentences on her, dad, three sentences on him. And these people are now NPCs under my control. And the agreement I'm going to make as a GM is I want these relationships to be part of the story. And truth be told, this is not something I've done a very good job of in the past. But at the same time, I'm not going to use them as a constant whip against you to where you have to ditch them from future characters. Because if you don't, I'm going to forever be using them as a vice on your character. And the one game I played in where I had a character who fell in love with another character, it was a PC NPC. It was a Star Wars game. I was playing.
Oh, yeah. No, talk slower.
I was playing a guy from who's from the Empire. Oh, and he came in his armor and said, I hear you have a Jedi problem. And she said, no, but I do need somebody to use the Force.
Wow. And so anyways, that's the cheesiest thing I've ever heard you say.
It was.
Excellent.
I will rinse my mouth out with a 357 later. But the point being that the relationship ended up developing just in a very in-character sort of way between my player characters from the Empire and an NPC who's actually a prisoner we had taken from the Rebellion. And it was just in the course of their conversation, it was like, you know what? Mapping out this guy's thought process, his growth, he's starting to fall for this woman. And, but once again, it was never used as a whip. And it was always this very organic part of the growth of the character. And I've kind of sat back and thought that, you know, why is that not in more of the games that we play? And I didn't write this character. Hell, I didn't even have any idea this event was going to occur. But let's say I had. Let's say I had written from the start this guy as a girlfriend. I could have written three or four sentences on a girlfriend, put it on a little tear sheet, handed it to the GM and said, okay, she's an NPC completely under your control. Here's the facts I want you to know about her. Beyond that, you know what? I'm not going to waste the mental cycles on her because I shouldn't. If I'm doing that, well, now suddenly she's a familiar or she's a...
I'm surprised you say that, actually.
Really? Why?
The reason why is because you are the largest proponent of GM rights I've ever met. And the idea that a PC writes one or two sentences on an NPC that the GM is going to play and just throws it at the GM and says, here's my two or three sentences, you take care of the rest. To where the GM now has to develop the character more. He has to bring that character to life. He has to play that character.
Well, I would say actually the reason it still fits into my GM rights platform is because I'm coming at it from the opposite direction. If you handed me three pages instead of three sentences, that's one more thing for me to memorize and learn inside out. Right. If you give me enough hook to where I understand, this is where she works, this is how she acts, this is why she likes you, and then let me develop her on the fly, it's a lot less for me to keep track of, and it also gives me a lot more play in terms of how exactly I want to work her into events.
Right.
And so that's why it still fits my GM platform.
Your pro GM platform. I'm actually against the pro GM platform.
I know.
I think that GM needs to do more work. And I say this as a GM.
That's fine. I have no fear there because you will never hand me a three-page write-up. So,
not a problem.
This would be like Brazil threatening the nuclear option.
I'm going to remember because I totally would do something like that.
Here's the thing.
Flooded Dan's email box before with things.
Here's the thing is that I would never hand Dan a three-page write-up, but I will talk his ear off for 3 hours about my character.
That is absolutely true. I think the only reason that hasn't happened lately is because of sheer distance and where we live. Yeah. If I was closer to you and by proximity closer to Eat Right, we would probably...
If you said, okay, we're starting a new campaign, everyone's my character, Chad, Thursday, dinner, 6 o'clock, go.
Yeah.
You know, it would...
It probably would happen, so...
You know, as the episode is nearing completion, I find it interesting that... When we were lining out the episode, and then when we first started talking about this topic, we were coming at it as relationships between NPCs, like deepening those relationships and deepening their personalities and integrating it in with the players. One of the examples was there's the guy behind the bar at the Color Animal Inn who gives you a quest, deepening that, not just expanding his personality, but integrating the character with the characters, where they become friends or they become business partners or they become something like that. You know, the princess that you save from the dragon just isn't a go-to contact or further quest giver. She's somebody that becomes an important character, a trusted friend, an ally, not just a...
Maybe even not for plot reasons, yeah. But just because you like her.
Yeah, not a notation on a character sheet, although that's fine too, but just that's something that you develop more. And you know what? We didn't talk about that. We didn't talk about that at all because the conversation instantaneously evolved into romance.
Well, part of that may be because that was what I came in specifically wanting to talk about, because for me, the pet peeve is that it seems like our characters are asexual sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not
all that, of my characters are.
It's not just that they're not in relationships right now and they're not actively pursuing them. They don't seem to have any interest in it at all. Mm-hmm. And that's something that bothers me. It's something, like I said, in my life, I'm a married person. It was something I was striving for. And it's something I saw missing in the characters. So that's, at least from my perspective, that's the way I wanted to approach the conversation, because my characters are missing something that I'm enjoying, which is being married.
I think we're taking it to the extreme, sort of right onto the romance. But I think that's just the far end point of what it could be. But even a friendship is, it's not a romance, but it is a mutual, strong friendship. Well, it's emotional.
It's an old thing.
So you're developing it's emotional relationships we're talking about.
Well, it's
developing more than just the business. Introducing that that level of emotion, very, very strong emotions, lead to that, you know, to the romance that we've sort of hit on.
It's like the Greeks have that, you know, five or six different words for love, but they all mean different things.
Yeah.
You know, the love between mother and father, love between friends, romantic love, sexual love.
Agape, storge.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's basically what we're talking about here is, if we don't talk about, I hate this NPC and want to kill him, we're talking about those different levels, and it's like we only focused on the romantic love. I just find it interesting. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think that we can do an entire episode on love relationships with character, NPC to character. And I think that we can do an entire episode on deepening NPC relationships that isn't romance, that isn't like that.
You know, and your observation is a really good one, too, in the mindset of, I never hear anyone else talk about that, but I'm even bothered in role-playing video games. I want relationships there. And if they give you the hints at it, but you can't develop it, that bothers me for the same reason.
Well, my character doesn't feel
fleshed out.
I think the reason we went straight for romance was partially because of pre-recording.
All about me, baby.
Well, partially pre-recording conversation. I think it's also because of the fact that it's probably the most tricky and emotionally charged. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I've made a note here, because I think you're absolutely right that we ought to talk about deepening the relationships between NPCs and also deepening the relationships between the NPCs and the parties, why the parties tend to treat NPCs as disposable and et cetera, et cetera. And that topic, I think there's a lot we can talk about there. So we'll come back to that probably next episode. Okay. And we'll just let this one rest on its laurels of having mostly been about romance.
Yeah. But and I think we can even do a further romance episode. How to make it work. When doesn't it work?
Yeah. So, you know what? If you guys have your thoughts, as always, get on the blog, get on the forum, let us know. I'm glad you all had a wonderful time at Fear the Con 3.
All five of you.
And I'm off to post tonight's episode and start printing the attendance sheets. So,
yes.
You guys have a great weekend. We will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in a non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.